content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, and continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the June 24th, 2016 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. ISIS-inspired terrorism in Orlando. What happened? An American-born gunman claiming allegiance to ISIS carried out the worst mass shooting in U.S. history last weekend, killing 49 people and injuring 53 others at a gay nightclub in Orlando. In an attack that reignited debates over Islamic extremism, gun control, and homophobia, Omar Mateen arrived at the packed Pulse Nights Club shortly after 2 a.m. on Sunday morning, wielding a semi-automatic Sig Sauer MCX assault rifle and a 9mm Glock handgun. After exchanging shots outside with an off-duty police officer, Mateen moved inside and began indiscriminately mowing people down. As revelers frantically tried to escape, hid, and played dead, he hunted them like cornered prey, emptying several 30-round magazines of bullets while laughing and shouted, "Allahu Akbar, God is great." When armed officers arrived, Mateen took several people hostage in the bathroom. After a three-hour standoff, during which Mateen pledged his allegiance to ISIS in a 911 call, SWAT teams stormed the building and killed him. As vigils for the victims were held across the country, investigators tried to discern Mateen's motives from his complicated, conflicted life. He was able to buy the two guns legally despite having been investigated by the FBI in 2013 and 2014 for suspected terror links. Mateen's first wife said she left him because he beat her. His second wife said he had told her he wanted to carry out an attack, but denied having known his specific plans. Mateen's father, who immigrated to the U.S. from Afghanistan, said his son recently reacted with disgust after seeing two men kiss in public. But Pulse regulars said the gunman often drank at the gay bar, and there's evidence he frequented gay online chat forums and used gay dating apps. Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, sparked an uproar by renewing his call for a ban on Muslims entering the country and questioning whether American Muslims were telling authorities about radicals in their midst. President Obama, who renewed his own calls for an assault weapons ban and stronger background checks, responded with an angry denunciation of Trump. "Are we going to start treating Muslim Americans differently?" he asked. "That's not the America we want. It will make us less safe." What the editorial said. Several factors contributed to this slaughter, said the New York Times. A radical strain of Islam that appeals to angry, disaffected people, law enforcement failures, and a vicious and virulent homophobia. But only one has a simple fix: the easy availability of guns. Military-style assault rifles are designed to kill a lot of people in very little time, yet these weapons of mass destruction are as easy to buy as cough medicine. That's why they were used by the killers in San Bernardino, Newtown, Aurora, and now Orlando. The United States does not have an assault weapons problem, said NationalReview.com. AR-15-style rifles are the most popular rifle in the U.S., and differ from ordinary semi-automatic sporting rifles only in their scary appearance and snap-on accessories. These weapons account for such a minuscule number of murders that law enforcement agencies do not even keep statistics on them. Indeed, when so-called assault weapons were banned between 1994 and 2004, there was no detectable effect on crime. The real problem here isn't guns, said the Washington Examiner. It's President Obama's half-hearted and half-cocked efforts to counter ISIS. Having initially dismissed the Middle Eastern jihadist group as the JV team of terrorism, he approved only limited airstrikes and special forces engagement. That allowed ISIS to grow into a monster big enough to seize half of Iraq and Syria and inspire terrorist attacks on the West. Until Obama takes the strong, robust military action needed to defeat these barbarians, there will be more San Bernardinos and even more Orlandos. What the columnist said. This awful massacre clearly targeted the LGBT community, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. But this isn't a moment for identity politics, which could muddle the significance of the carnage. The gunman's attack was on freedom itself, on a society that celebrates diverse points of view, diverse systems of belief, diverse ways to love. Reinstating the 1994 ban on assault rifles won't stop mass shooting attacks, said Alex Yablon in Slate.com. The legislation defined the weapons by cosmetic features, allowing gun makers to evade the restrictions with small aesthetic moderations. A far more effective strategy would be a ban on high-capacity magazines, which allow shooters to fire off as many as 30 bullets in seconds without having to reload. Terrorists are changing their tactics, said Megan McArdle in BloombergView.com. Instead of sending trained loyalists to launch spectacular attacks on well-defended landmarks, they're encouraging lone wolf followers to buy guns and shoot up nightclubs, shopping centers, and other soft targets. Anticipating and stopping these decentralized attacks will be very, very difficult. Even defeating ISIS won't solve this problem, said Leonid Bershitsky in BloombergView.com. Most ISIS supporters like Mateen aren't fanatically religious. They're disillusioned young men who want to wreak havoc on societies they believe have rejected them in some way. When ISIS is gone, aspiring terrorists will simply find another vehicle to carry their personal hatreds and grievances. And a second main story. Clinton woos Sanders to unite against Trump. What happened? Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton and rival Senator Bernie Sanders edged toward an uneasy alliance this week as their bruising primary battle came to an end and the party sought to unify for the general election against Donald Trump. In what both campaigns called a positive discussion, Clinton and Sanders met in Washington, D.C., where the former Secretary of State had just cruised to a 79% to 21% victory in the season's final primary. A Sanders official said the pair talked about the dangerous threat that Trump poses to the nation. But the Vermont senator, who won 22 nominating contests, stopped short of endorsing Clinton, whom he has skewered for her ties to Wall Street. He did soften his rhetoric, saying he'd use his clout to shape the most progressive platform in party history, rather than carry his fight to the next month's Democratic convention in Philadelphia. The self-declared Democratic Socialist wants the party to support universal health care, free college tuition, and Wall Street reforms. He also hopes to change the nominating process, opening up primaries to non-Democrats and eliminating superdelegates, party leaders who can back any candidate regardless of how their own states vote. We need major, major changes, Sanders said. With the primaries over, the parties coalesced around Clinton, who last week won the backing of President Obama and progressive Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Their endorsements helped fuel a surge in the polls for Clinton. She led Trump 49-37 nationally in a new Bloomberg.com survey, and a Politico.com poll this week showed Clinton with an edge in 8 of 11 crucial swing states. What the editorial said. Sanders might have lost this battle, but he has a lot to feel proud about, said the New York Times. His campaign divined and channeled the lingering pain of a middle class battered by recession and feeling shut out of a recovery in which only Wall Street seemed to prosper. Now Clinton faces a daunting challenge: how to generate the same passion from the legions of mostly young voters who at rally after rally sat through an hour's worth of economic lecturing from a wild-haired man they found to be honest and authentic. "It's Sanders' job to mobilize his millions of disaffected fans," said the Baltimore Sun. "He's spent the past 6 months lambasting Clinton, and now many of his Bernie or bust backers are threatening to stay home or even pull the lever for Trump, claiming they want to vote for someone who will shake up the system. Unless Sanders is eager to repeat the destructive spoiler role Ralph Nader played in 2000, he must convince those supporters there's a big difference between the Democratic and Republican nominees." What the columnist said: Sanders can make a strong progressive case for backing Hillary, said David Cole in TheNation.com. On virtually every issue, he and Clinton are on the same page. She wants to reduce inequality, overturn Citizens United, end mass incarceration and racial profiling, reform our broken immigration system, and advance health care for all. Their biggest differences are strategic. Sanders wants immediate change. Clinton understands that most progressive reforms in this country have come about incrementally, not through revolutionary moments. "Clinton is about to clean Donald Trump's clock," said Michael Tomasky in TheDailyBeast.com. An Electoral College forecast by the University of Georgia elections analyst Josh Putnam gives her a 364-174 edge. A Survey USA poll showed Hillary and the Donald tied in deep red Utah. Any number of events, such as the FBI investigation into Clinton's private email server, could upend the race. But if the election were held today, Trump would find himself forever labeled with his own favorite insult: loser. "If establishment Democrats had any brains, they wouldn't be high-fiving right now," said Matt Taibbi in RollingStone.com. "They should be horrified that their chosen candidate took so long to defeat a quirky socialist, almost completely lacking big-dollar donors or institutional support." Both the Sanders and Trump insurgencies this year were a blistering referendum on Beltway politics. Voters are sick of being ignored while politicians service corporate donors. No doubt party leaders are too dense to listen, but they ignore the unrest at their peril. Controversy of the week: Orlando. Trump blames Muslims and Obama. "It had not seemed possible," said the Washington Post in an editorial, "but Donald Trump descended this week to a new low. As America awoke Sunday morning to the horror of the Orlando nightclub massacre, the presumptive Republican nominee was already using Twitter to thank supporters for the congrats on being right about radical Islamic terrorism, adding later in triumph, "I called it." Trump's hideous and bigoted comments the next day were even worse, said Isaac Schottenair in Slate.com. In a policy speech in response to Orlando, Trump doubled down on his call for a ban on Muslims entering the U.S. and threatened American Muslims with big consequences if they don't work with us to identify jihadists in their midst. In TV interviews, Trump also called on President Obama to resign in disgrace for not using the words radical Islam in his comments on the massacre, and suggested that Obama continues to prioritize our enemy and might himself be sympathetic to Islamic terrorism. The prospect of a Trump presidency has been giving many Americans nightmares for months, but this week's grotesque display of bigotry, cynicism, and paranoia is proof that stopping him is both a practical and moral necessity. Trump's rhetoric is certainly crude and unnuanced, said William McGurn in WSJ.com, but it's not hard to understand its popular appeal. We've been under attack by radical Islam since 9/11. Yet for 7 long years, Obama and Hillary Clinton have avoided using the word Islam unless it's time to lecture their fellow citizens about anti-Muslim bigotry. The president has a duty to be clear-eyed about national security and the things that threaten it, said M.G. Opreya in TheFederalist.com. Obama, however, has spent his presidency downplaying any connection between Islam and terrorism whatsoever, a politically correct denial of reality that sadly hit home over the weekend in Florida. If anyone's acting like an ISIS sleeper agent, it's Trump, said William Salatin in Slate.com. The reason Obama, like President Bush before him, takes such pains to avoid connecting terrorism with Islam is, for the 100th time, that he's actually trying to defeat the terrorist. Without the support of Muslim governments and the 1.6 billion Muslims around the world, we have no hope of beating ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the rest of radical Islam. Trump is doing exactly what ISIS wants, alienating moderate Muslim Americans by making them suspicious others in their own land and portraying terrorism as a religious war between Christianity and Islam, making all Muslims complicit in the actions of a tiny minority is wrong, said Michael Tanner in nationalreview.com. It's no different from stereotyping and demonizing all gun owners. If Trump's demonization of all Muslims became official government policy, it would lead to more self-radicalization and make the Muslim community here less, not more, likely to cooperate with law enforcement. Sadly, Trump's divisive fear-mongering may work for him politically, said Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. When people are scared, they become far more susceptible to appeals to bigotry and hate. This time, though, Trump may have gone overboard, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. Appalled Republican lawmakers, including House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senators Bob Corker and Ron Johnson, called Trump's attack on Muslims and Obama's loyalty disappointing and offensive. A new CBS News poll, meanwhile, found that just 25% of Americans approve of Trump's comments on Orlando. Trump just faced his first big leadership test, and his unhinged response may wind up raising further doubts about his temperamental fitness for the presidency. It was a good week for standing up for yourself. After Baltimore Orioles infielder Manny Machado was offered free crab cakes for life from a local restaurant for punching Kansas City pitcher Yordano Ventura, who hit him with a 99-mile-per-hour fastball. It was a good week for James Savage, a 9-year-old boy who became the youngest person to swim to Alcatraz Island and back, stroking through 2 miles of cold, rough water in San Francisco Bay. It was a good week for white knights after a newlywed bride in her wedding gown stopped to administer life-saving CPR outside a Pittsburgh hotel. "My nursing instincts took over," said off-duty trauma nurse Julie Strawn Nixon. "Never knew that would happen on my wedding night." But it was a bad week for stings after a Canadian motorist was ticketed for removing his seatbelt while giving money to an undercover cop he mistook for a homeless person. "I'm quite upset," Dane Rusk said after being issued a $175 fine. "I thought I was doing a good deed." It was a bad week for splitting hairs after anti-Gawker crusader Peter Thiel demanded that the gossip site remove an investigative story revealing that Donald Trump's signature hairstyle may be the result of $60,000 hair extension treatments. The story was false and defamatory, Thiel's lawyer warned the beleaguered media company. And it was a bad week for big tips. After a server at a Colorado Thai restaurant received a $1,000 tip, delighting the whole staff, until the customer returned the next morning and asked for it back. "I'm sorry. I was drunk," the customer said. Moving over to the briefing page, Saudi Arabia and 9/11. The U.S. government is considering declassifying a controversial 28-page section of a congressional report on 9/11. Why is it controversial? Those pages concern whether or not Saudi Arabian officials were involved in funding or supporting the hijackers. In 2002, the bipartisan Joint Congressional Inquiry conducted an extensive investigation into the intelligence failures in the lead-up to 9/11. President George W. Bush sealed this section covering Saudi Arabia's possible involvement, presumably to avoid damaging relations with one of America's closest Middle Eastern allies. Since then, the 28 pages have been locked in a basement room at the U.S. Capitol. Lawmakers can read them, but are forbidden from revealing their exact contents. Spearheading the campaign to have them declassified is former Senator Bob Graham, who co-chaired the inquiry. The 28 pages primarily relate to who financed 9/11, he said last year, and they point a very strong finger at Saudi Arabia. Why are the pages still sealed? The official rationale is that they identify people whose alleged complicity was never proved. The 9/11 Commission followed up on the original inquiry and concluded in 2004 that there was no evidence the Saudi government or senior Saudi officials aided al-Qaeda in the run-up to the attacks, even though 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. Last year, an internal CIA investigation came to the same conclusion. Yet neither report ruled out the possibility that lower-level government officials were involved. John Layman, a former Navy secretary under President Reagan who served on the 9/11 Commission, said the report found evidence that at least five Saudi officials helped the hijackers. There was an awful lot of participation by Saudi individuals in supporting the hijackers, and some of those people worked in the Saudi government, he said. Our report should never have been read as an exoneration of Saudi Arabia. So what do we know? It is well established that Saudi Arabia's royal family, the House of Saud, had very close ties to President Bush and his father, President George H.W. Bush. Saudi investment firms poured money into Bush Senior's oil business, and the country provided the U.S. with an invaluable support during the first Gulf War. 2 days after 9/11, Saudi Arabia's influential ambassador to Washington, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, met with President Bush at the White House, and the two men smoked cigars on the Truman balcony. Over the next few days, the Saudis were allowed to collect more than 160 Saudi officials, including relatives of Osama bin Laden, from around the U.S. and fly them on chartered jets to Saudi Arabia. Some even received an FBI escort to the airports. What about before the attacks? Much of the focus has been on Omar al-Bayoumi, who the FBI suspected was a Saudi intelligence officer. When two of the hijackers arrived in Los Angeles in January 2000, al-Bayoumi met with them in a restaurant, took them to San Diego, and set them up in an apartment, co-signing the lease and advancing them $1,500 for rent. He later helped the pair, who spoke almost no English, find a flight school. Al-Bayoumi insisted the restaurant meeting was a chance encounter and that he was just helping out fellow Muslims. but he was also in regular contact with Fahad al-Thumari, a Saudi consulate official who was deported in 2003 for suspected terrorist links, and with Anwar al-Awlaki, the radical American-born Islamic preacher who helped inspire several terrorist attacks. Al-Bayoumi was questioned by the FBI, but released without charge. Is there any other evidence of complicity? During 2000 and 2001, Al-Bayoumi received about $3,000 a month through several intermediaries from Prince Bandar's wife. Many suspect some of this cash was passed on to the hijackers. Bandar has also been accused by Zacharias Moussoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, of being one of al-Qaeda's donors in the run-up to the attacks. The Saudi government said Moussoui is mentally ill and unreliable, vehemently denies that it had any involvement in 9/11, and has even called on the U.S. government to release the notorious 28 pages. Saudi Arabia has nothing to hide, Bandar said in 2003. We can deal with questions in public, but we cannot respond to blank pages. Why is this coming up now? Congress is considering a bill that would allow U.S. citizens to sue Saudi Arabia for its alleged support of the hijackers. Foreign governments currently receive immunity from prosecution in the U.S., but the new legislation, which was passed unanimously by the Senate, would grant exceptions when countries are found culpable of involvement in terrorist attacks. Saudi Arabia has threatened to sell $750 billion of U.S.-based assets if the bill is enacted. Many members of Congress argue that releasing the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry's findings in full would shed light on whether the Saudis have some specific allegations to answer. There are a lot of coincidences, said former Representative Tim Romer. Is that enough to make you squirm and feel uncomfortable and dig harder and declassify these 28 pages? Absolutely. How Bandar Bush helped the home team. At the heart of the close relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia on 9/11 was one man, Prince Bandar. A grandson of the Gulf state's founding king, Bandar was the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. from 1983 to 2005, and went on to run his country's intelligence agency. He was so close to the Bushes, he was often called Bandar Bush, and he was instrumental in persuading his government to assist the U.S. in the first Gulf War. In 2003, he was briefed by Bush Jr. on the plan to invade Iraq, 2 days before Vice President Dick Cheney or Secretary of State Colin Powell. In Washington, Bandar was a master of diplomacy. His opulent parties were legendary. His other nickname was the Arab Gatsby, and he cultivated relationships with the administration's most powerful figures. Shortly after Powell resigned in 2005, for example, Bandar presented him with a 1995 Jaguar, a car Powell's wife had once mentioned in passing that she liked. But there was never any doubt over whose side Bandar was on. Don't expect the man not to play the game for his home team, said William Simpson, Bandar's biographer. The home team is Saudi Arabia. Time for a few of the best columns from the week. The first from the U.S., the inevitable global pandemic. A year ago, the world was in a panic over Ebola, said public health expert Dr. Ali Khan. Now it's Zika at the gate. What's next? Though Americans fixate on exotic diseases to the point of hysteria, the next pandemic will probably be caused by some new strain of the flu. People think of influenza as something that makes the kids miss a day or two of school. But the virus can be deadly. A novel strain of influenza called the Spanish flu killed 50 million people around the globe in 1918, more than all combat deaths in World War I and World War II combined. Today, in a world of jet travel, a lethal new flu strain would spread very rapidly and could produce even more horrific consequences. The bird flu virus, for example, isn't very contagious among humans, but kills 60% of those who do get infected. A more communicable mutation could wipe out tens of millions of people. What to do? Invest in national and international public health protection systems, rather than letting them limp along underfunded and mostly ignored until the next pandemic strikes. As Louis Pasteur once warned, gentlemen, it is the microbe who will have the last word. This column from Belgium. Not remotely safe from terrorism. Belgium isn't taking the terrorist threat seriously, says Thierry Oliver. As a visiting professor from Quebec, I travel frequently by train between Paris and Brussels. I expected, after the November terrorist attacks in Paris, and even more so after the March attacks in Brussels airport and subway system, that Belgium would have raced to put in place new checks and surveillance systems at major transit hubs. At the very least, more guards and police. But no. A few days after jihadists killed 130 people in Paris, I boarded a high-speed Brussels to Paris train. In the Brussels station, there was not a single security guard on the platform, and nobody was there to check tickets. Anyone could board. Luggage and boxes were piled up on the platform to be loaded unchecked. 2 months after the Brussels attacks, I took the same train. Again, nobody checked bags or tickets. Contrast this with the return trip from Paris to Brussels. In Paris, baggage is now x-rayed, and access to the trains is strictly controlled, for ticket holders only. Police are everywhere. Belgium authorities have made grand statements and posturings trying to reassure themselves and the world that all is safe. Instead, we see denial, incompetence, and lack of resources, a dangerous mix. In this column from Russia, does Putin favor Trump or Clinton? The Kremlin isn't taking sides in the U.S. presidential race, said Vladimir Makeyev. Democratic presumptive nominee Hillary Clinton has warned that if Donald Trump wins the presidency, they'll be celebrating in the Kremlin. But political analysts in Russia say it's not that clear-cut. It's true that during Soviet times, as well as more recently, our leaders have found Republican administrations easier to negotiate with. More deals and accords have been struck under Republican presidents than under Democratic ones. But the Kremlin is wary of Trump, says analyst Vadim Kozulin, because he is a person of emotions, lacking sophisticated knowledge and experience in foreign policy. On the other hand, there's reason for caution about Clinton, because she is more interventionist, always on the lookout for an overseas mission for the U.S. Armed Forces. But she's also pragmatic and would know better than to antagonize Russia when the real threat to America is China. No matter who wins, the Kremlin doesn't expect U.S.-Russian relations to improve. Political scientist Fyodor Votolovsky says that if he were advising President Vladimir Putin, I would suggest having neither gleeful illusions about Trump nor gruesome apprehensions about Clinton. Our last word article this week is titled, The Man Behind the Massacre. As a teen, Orlando gunman Omar Mateen was a bullied loner who cheered the September 11th attacks, says reporter William Wan and Ann Hull. But he also socialized at the mall, drank at parties, and visited gay bars. Kevin West said he was in the parking lot at the Pulse nightclub at 1 a.m. Sunday when he recognized Omar Mateen walking in. The men had met more than a year before when Mateen reached out to West on Jacked, a dating app for men. Then they lost touch until 3 months ago when Mateen made contact again, mentioned that he would be in Orlando soon, and suggested meeting for a drink. West had also seen Mateen at Pulse multiple times. "I remember details," said West, a 30-year-old Navy veteran. "I never forget a face." Later that night, Mateen would kill 49 people inside the gay nightclub in Orlando in the worst mass shooting in U.S. history. Mateen's apparent presence on gay dating apps and his previous visits to Pulse, according to West and other witnesses, added another dimension to the portrait emerging Monday of the man behind the violent rampage. Cord Sedino of Orlando said he had also seen Mateen inside Pulse before, standing at the bar with a drink. "He was open with his picture on the sights. He was easy to recognize," said Sedino, 23, adding that he was also contacted by Mateen at least a year ago on a dating app. Mateen and his family had the typical profile of striving immigrants in this country. But there were also hints of darkness in Mateen's life, according to interviews with relatives, friends, ex-classmates, former co-workers, and acquaintances. Being Afghan-American meant he stood out in a small southern Florida town and was bullied in school. He switched jobs constantly and became increasingly frustrated, unpredictable, sporadically religious, and prone to anger. Some of Mateen's high school classmates pinpointed a particularly strange moment on September 11, 2001, when they were watching the attack on the World Trade Center unfold live on TV. Four classmates said Mateen cheered and made mocking comments, which got him pulled from class and may have led to his departure from school. His unusual behavior that day was corroborated by other classmates in public posts on Facebook. The Martin County School District referred all questions about Mateen's time as a student to the FBI. Robert Zirkle, then a freshman in the Martin School District, said that after 9/11, he saw Mateen excited and making fun of how America was attacked. "He was making plane noises on the bus, acting like he was running into a building," Zirkle recalled. "I don't really know if he was doing it because he was being taught some stuff at home, or just doing it for attention because he didn't have a lot of friends. We all rode the same bus. We weren't really close friends, but friends at least a little," he said. After 9/11 happened, he started changing and acting different. At the time, Mateen was attending the Spectrum Alternative School, a campus in Stuart, Florida, for students with behavioral issues. One former student was sitting in the same class as Mateen, said he remembers the morning of 9/11 clearly. "Teacher said, 'Turn on the TV. We see the one plane hit, and then see the second plane hit.' He was smiling. It was almost like surreal how happy he was about what happened to us." The former student said Mateen stood up after the second tower was hit and claimed that Osama bin Laden was his uncle. "Back then, we didn't even really know who Osama bin Laden was," the classmate said. "But he talked about shooting AK-47s. He said he shot them and his uncle taught him how to shoot them." The ex-classmate spoke on the condition of anonymity for fear that business clients would find out that he'd attended a school for poorly behaving students. He recalled others in the class growing angry. "The teacher could tell we wanted to hurt him. So the teacher grabbed him," he said, "and sent him to the dean's office." In a Facebook post, another student similarly described Mateen's standing up and cheering on 9/11. A third classmate said he distinctly remembers Mateen's actions that day because both of them were sent to the dean's office at the same time for acting out when the towers were hit. That third student spoke on the condition of anonymity because he feared being bombarded by media requests. I was sleeping in class and woke up to see people jumping off buildings, so I started swearing and they sent me up, the former student said. When he arrived at the dean's office, Mateen was also there, apparently for saying rude things about Americans deserving to be attacked, said the student, who was not in the classroom to witness the comments. The first former classmate who was in the classroom vividly recalled Mateen's father picking him up after he got in trouble. I remember his dad walking up, he said, and in the courtyard in front of everyone, the dad slapped him right across the face. After that day, Zirkle said, he kept doing it and saying crazy things. It's weird. He was totally cool before 9/11, then something changed. Zirkle and others think Mateen was suspended or expelled from the school shortly afterward. But such memories don't fit with those of Kenneth Winstanley, a friend of Mateen's in junior high and high school, who said he did not recall Mateen celebrating the 9/11 attacks and doubted his friend would have done that. Winstanley was not in the same room as Mateen that day. I never heard about him doing anything like that, said Winstanley, who attended school with Mateen from grades 6 through 10. Someone would have said something. We were friends. If he was caught celebrating something like that, he would have gotten beaten up. Winstanley said he never saw signs of radicalization in Mateen in high school, adding, I know Omar liked America. He said the two once had a conversation about Mateen's Muslim faith. Omar explained that Muslim religion to me, Winstanley said. He didn't go crazy into it. It was just some of the things his culture does, the food they eat. Nothing radical Islam at all. Sarah Zaidi, who was best friends with one of Mateen's three sisters, described the Mateens as an all-American family. His mom worked for a while at a daycare center. His dad did stuff with stocks and investments, Zaidi said. They were pretty moderate as Muslims. None of the sisters or mom even wore a headscarf like some Muslims do. Two of Mateen's sisters are now married and have kids in the same area, Zaidi said. A third is a hairdresser and cosmetologist. But as the only son, Mateen seemed to have fewer friends than his sisters. He was brutally bullied, said Justin DeLancey, who rode the bus with Mateen for several years. He was a chubby kid and got bullied about his weight. He was probably one of the only kids of Arab descent. That made him stand out a bit as well. On some mornings, kids wouldn't let Mateen sit beside them. On others, he'd get slapped on the back of the head, DeLancey said. He'd try to joke and laugh and make fun of himself to get the attention off of himself, but it didn't work. Court records released Monday depict a meandering life for Mateen after he left the alternative school. He graduated in 2006 from Martin County's Adult Vocational School, where struggling students go to get GEDs. He earned an associate's degree from Indian River State College in 2006. In the court documents, Mateen disclosed his work history, a string of jobs from 2002 to 2006 at GNC, Hollister, Gold's Gym, Nutrition World, Walgreens, Chick-fil-A, Circuit City, and Publix. In 2009, Mateen married Sitora Yusufi, who has said in interviews that Mateen beat her severely. They separated about 9 months later. A judge ruled in 2011 that their marriage was irretrievably broken. He married a second time, and his current wife, Noor Z. Salman, also left him to return to her childhood home in Rodeo, California, with their three-year-old son, acquaintances said. Salman is reportedly cooperating with FBI and has told investigators she tried to talk Mateen out of the attack. Friends and coworkers gave conflicting report about Mateen's religiosity and personality. To some, he was extremely pious and serious. but others described him chasing girls, going to parties, and drinking. "He was fun," said Ryan Jones, 27, who said he often went out with Mateen. Former classmate Samuel King and his friends also hung out with Mateen at the mall, where Mateen worked at the GNC store after high school, and King at Ruby Tuesday. Half of the workers at the restaurant were openly gay, King said, including himself. He had to know it, but I never got any sense of homophobia or aggression from him. Over the past 2 days, King and others have revisited their interactions with Mateen, trying to find signs of how he became someone capable of such violence. On Monday, Mateen's father, Sadiq Mateen, insisted that his son was not motivated by Islamist radical ideology, describing the 29-year-old as a good son who did not seem agitated or angry in the days before the shooting. In an interview at his home in Port St. Lucie, Florida, the father offered no hints about what could have driven his son. When asked about Mateen's 9/11 call pledging loyalty to ISIS, his father said he did not believe it was genuine. "I think he just wanted to boast of himself," he said. "No radicalism, no. He doesn't have a beard even. I don't think religion or Islam has anything to do with this." His father also glossed over the anger and homophobia that, a day earlier, he recounted witnessing in Mateen after his son saw a gay couple being affectionate in Miami. "He was surprised about it. That was it." In a video posted to Facebook early Monday, the father said, "God himself will punish those involved in homosexuality. This is not for the servants of God." Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, government officials were also trying to piece together the family's background for clues. They said they do not know when Mateen's father left the country, but noted that millions fled after the Soviet Union's invasion in 1979. Mateen's father, however, maintained a strong affiliation with Afghanistan, hosting a television show broadcast from California that weighed in on the country's political affairs. He also filmed dozens of sparsely viewed, rambling YouTube videos portraying himself as an important Afghan analyst and leader. The most recent video on the father's YouTube channel shows him declaring his candidacy for the Afghan presidency. But the timing is strange, coming a year after Afghanistan's presidential elections were held. And the elder Mateen appears incoherent at times in the video, jumping abruptly from topic to topic. Sitting on his living room couch, the father said he saw no warning signs up to the day before the shootings, when he last saw his son. "He was well behaved. His appearance was perfect," he said. "I did not see any sign of worrying or being upset or nervous." This was originally published in the Washington Post. On the Health and Science page, obesity surges among women. More than 40% of American women are obese, a 5% jump over the past decade, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, reports. It's a really alarming figure, and it's alarming that it's continuing to go up despite government calls to action on weight loss and healthy eating, UCLA Medical Center dietitian Dana Huns tells The Guardian. Obesity is calculated by measuring a person's body mass index, a ratio of weight to height. For example, at 5'4", the average height for a U.S. woman, someone who weighs 174 pounds or more is considered obese. The condition is most common among African-American women, 57% of whom qualify as obese, compared with 47% of Hispanic women, 38% of white women, and 12% of Asian women. The rate of obesity among men remains 35%, with no increase since 2005. After analyzing information compiled on more than 5,000 adults, The CDC found no explanation for why women struggle more than men do with this serious health issue, which is associated with heart disease, diabetes, and certain cancers. What's clear, however, is that the billions of dollars spent on weight loss devices, drugs, research, and community programs have done little to curb the nation's 30-year-long obesity epidemic. Researchers suggest no progress will be made until the food and restaurant industries apply their marketing skills to promote healthier options. And moving right into the talking points page. Transplants, creating human pig chimeras. Human organs grown inside pigs are the stuff of science fiction, said Samantha Allen in the DailyBeast.com. The scientists are already at work on a project to do just that, with the goal of solving a critical shortage of donated organs and saving countless lives. Researchers at the University of California have injected human stem cells into pig embryos, hoping to produce pigs that have human pancreases. It's an intricate process, with scientists first deleting the piece of pig DNA responsible for the animal's pancreas and substituting the stem cells to create a human one. Creating such chimeras, as mixed species creatures are called, presents a uniquely 21st century ethical quandary. What if science starts growing pigs with human hearts? And if the stem cell injections make pigs' brains more human too? When does the animal become a human in a pig's body? This is surely one of the most nauseating developments of our time, said A.N. Wilson in the Daily Mail. Even the scientists involved admit they do not know where these latest experiments could lead. Stem cells can develop into any form of tissue, and there is nothing to stop them from migrating to the pig's brain and, yes, imparting human characteristics. If we truly value the precious distinctiveness of being human, is it worth preserving life at whatever cost, even if it blurs the line between pigs and people? True, human stem cells might make pigs a little smarter, said ethicist Jonathan Hughes in theconversation.com. That's what happened to mice injected with human stem cells. But it's implausible that a pig would acquire anything like human consciousness. A more credible ethical dilemma is whether we have the right to create thousands of human-animal hybrids so we can kill them and harvest their organs. Granted, we slaughter pigs for food, but that's weak justification for extending animal exploitation to a new arena. Tell that to more than 120,000 Americans on waiting lists for life-saving organ transplants, said Ronald Bailey in Reason.com. Every day, some 22 of them die for lack of an available organ. Critics contend the pig experiments are inherently damaging to our sense of humanity and dignity, but this is nonsense. Bioethicist David Shaw asked the right question. Is it dignified to let people suffer and die when we could use this new biotechnology to provide them with organs that will let them live long and happy lives? And moving into some of the shorter notes. At the time of the Orlando massacre, the U.S. had already experienced 133 mass shootings in 2016, according to the FBI definition of a mass shooting as a single event in which four or more people are shot. It was the 15th mass shooting in Florida this year and the fourth in Orlando. Stanford University reported a sexual assault to police once every 2 weeks on average in 2015, according to figures from the U.S. Department of Education. Light pollution caused by city lights is now so prevalent that a whole third of humanity cannot see the bright smear of the Milky Way in the night sky, including 80% of Americans and 60% of Europeans. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton got more votes in the 2008 primary, which she lost to Barack Obama, than this year when she won. In 2008, Clinton and Obama got more than 17 million votes each. This year, thanks to lower turnout, Clinton got just over 14 million votes. For the first time since 1979, America's cars, trucks, and airplanes emit more carbon dioxide than its power plants do. That's largely because plants are using much less coal and more natural gas to generate electricity. From the It Wasn't All Bad section, Sean Squires hates the idea of any animal going hungry. So when the Newfoundland man heard that his local pet store was going out of business, he decided to buy its entire discounted inventory of dog and cat food, some 570 bags and cans, and donate it all to animal shelters. He paid nearly $3,000 for $13,000 worth of food. "I thought it was the normal thing to do," he said. At home, Squires cares for 9 stray cats. "I'm not even a cat person, but you can't not help them." On the poll watch, 59% of Americans support the U.S. taking in Middle Eastern refugees after screening them for security risks, including 77% of Democrats. 41% oppose taking Middle Eastern refugees, including 63% of Republicans and 77% of Trump supporters. And we'll finish today with a quote from Toni Morrison. She says, "Remember that your real job is that if you are free, you need to free someone else. If you have some power, then your job is to empower someone else." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.